Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, March 5th. Just a reminder, I am not a trader and don't have that kind of mentality when coming up with a forecast. I take things one year at a time when looking at the world, and so after another tumultuous week, though one where stocks ended up just fractionally across the board, I need to repeat that you're not going to get any big picture changes from yours truly. But I will summarize the talking points that lead to my overall outlook for both the political picture and the equity market in particular. Stocks News is half a report on what has transpired over the week, and the other half identifying the hotspots that can shape investor sentiment and consumer confidence. Long ago, one of my tenants was a car bomb going off in Sri Lanka doesn't have an impact on U.S. markets, but one going off in Tel Aviv might. In these last few weeks, we've been reminded that geopolitics matter. So this week, let's start there, specifically the Middle East. When it comes to Libya, U.S. policy is a mess. First off, I can understand why President Obama did not want to act or even say much until American citizens were removed, but many of them should not have been there in the first place, and I would like to think, because of the delay in getting them out, that we didn't miss an opportunity to eliminate Gaddafi and potentially save a lot of bloodshed, let alone maintain the flow of oil there. I'm not talking in any way about a large-scale operation, but a covert one. I bring this up because just as I did when I went to Albania and Beirut last year, I notify the U.S. State Department of my intentions whenever I go somewhere not exactly on the approved list for American travelers. Everyone should do that. But I'm also a big boy, and I know if all hell breaks loose, while it would be nice to be plucked out like in some Hollywood adventure film, I recognize I'm largely on my own and I'm not about to bitch if my government can't rescue me. Again, all the more reason to at least drop them a note so they might be motivated to at least make the effort. The preceding aside, Defense Secretary Gates refuting Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's initial talk of a no-fly zone reminded us of a few things. First, at times like this, it's important to look at a map and be reminded that Libya is over twice the size of Iraq, where the United States and its allies enforced a no-fly zone prior to the expulsion of Saddam. Libya is huge. And while you could say, hey, you only have to cover a few major areas, that's not true. Gaddafi can fly in mercenaries under weapons in a number of desert airstrips all over the place. Gates also warned that you can't put together a no-fly zone without first destroying Libya's air defenses. Only then can you, quote, fly planes around the country and not worry about our guys being shot down, close quote. Gates, who has the support of Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen, added, there's a lot of talk, frankly, loose talk, about some of these military options, referring not to just Clinton, but also British Prime Minister David Cameron, who first came out for military action. An editorial in the New York Post summed it up perfectly. President Obama, yesterday, Thursday, for the first time publicly called for Muammar Gaddafi to step aside in the midst of the increasingly bloody revolt in Libya. Muammar al-Gaddafi has lost the legitimacy to lead and he must leave, Obama said at the White House. Okay, now what? For all the public rhetoric, Team Obama seems totally at sea regarding the current crisis. Case in point, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in recent days has talked up the idea of imposing a no-fly zone. Defense Secretary Gates demurred. That caused British Prime Minister David Cameron, who'd also sounded enthusiastic about the idea, to abruptly pull back support given what he saw as Washington's hesitancy. Yesterday, however, Obama insisted that a no-fly zone is one of the options that we would be looking at. If the president means to confuse Gaddafi about his plans, he's succeeding. Problem is, the U.S. public and America's allies are bewildered as well. The administration has been lurching about since the start of the Egyptian demonstrations that toppled Hosni Mubarak, and the public signs have been conflicting too. First, the administration stood behind Mubarak, then played a catch-up and called for his ouster. Likewise with Gaddafi. For all of Obama's insistence on being very unambiguous about this, he and his administration have yet to show the faintest hint of a coherent strategy, to say nothing of constructive leadership. Nothing good can develop in such a vacuum, but plenty of mischief is possible. Indeed, it's inevitable. We will continue to send a clear message, the president said yesterday, and with a straight face, too, Does he think nobody is noticing? That was an editorial from the New York Post. In Libya itself, I was struck by the oil chief who said on Monday that production had been cut by around 50%, arguing it was safe for foreign oil workers to return after their mass exodus. Not quite. Instead, they've either been running into the sea like lemmings or fleeing to Tunisia, thus presenting that new government with a refugee crisis of massive proportions. NATO has been powerless, the European response pathetic, and UN-US sanctions are equally ineffective in stopping Gaddafi from destroying his country. And at midweek, the story crossed that the Arab League was seriously considering a peace overture from none other than Hugo Chavez. No one knows how the chaos in the Middle East is all going to shake out. It's anyone's guess what the region will look like a year from now. But on February 19th, I took a stab at it and said of Libya, quote, the regime should succeed in beating down the protesters, but at a high cost, close quote. Meanwhile, Tunisia ousted its second leader as protesters continue to press for more and more concessions, though elections are now set for July. Egypt replaced its interim prime minister with the transport minister, Essam Sharaf, who has been a supporter of the opposition. Bahrain is still tense, but I maintain no way the Saudis will let it fall into Iran's orbit. Saudi Arabia itself will totally crush any opposition to the status quo. While in Jordan, the main opposition IAF party, the political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, has given the government 1 month to implement further reforms. As for Iran, there was talk that the two main opposition leaders, Mousavi and Karoubi, had been arrested, though it's actually house arrest, were either to be executed for treason, as many in the Iranian parliament want, that would be the end of the regime. The Iranian people and the world has its limits. Crackdowns on the citizenry, while brutal, will, I imagine, continue to be tolerated. But to execute a leader or two, that's something entirely different. And from everything I know, Ayatollah Khamenei, who would be calling the shots, is loath to take such an extreme measure. If we were to wake one day to news of this sort, though, my guess is Khamenei's own days would then be numbered, and that he had been superseded by an even more extremist element, at which point I'd short the U.S. stock market in a heartbeat. In Lebanon, caretaker Prime Minister Saad Hariri, and that's an absurd title at this point, spent his first day in the opposition, having refused to join a new coalition government, blasting Hezbollah. Hariri is showing far more spine these days than he ever has, and in what was described as a fiery speech said of Hezbollah and its weapons, we will continue to reiterate these simple and clear facts calmly and with responsibility and in a democratic way. We will repeat these facts through all available peaceful means until you confess that this problem has become a national problem and needs a national solution before anything else, because it is poisoning everything else and we will not allow it from now on to poison the memory of our martyrs. Hariri vowed Hezbollah could not poison the search for the truth into the assassination of his father in 2005. Hariri continued, we want to tell you, Hezbollah, that just because you have weapons, this doesn't mean that you are right. The weapons may give control, but they don't give a majority. The majority is produced by the ballot boxes, without weapons. The majority expresses its views in the parliament, without weapons. And in Pakistan, last week I reiterated that when it comes to this hellhole, it, quote, could come under the spell of extremists with a few bullets placed into the skulls of just a handful of current leaders, close quote. Well, then on Wednesday, assassins sent by Al-Qaeda or the Taliban killed the only Christian member of Pakistan's federal cabinet, the second assassination in 2 months of a high-profile opponent of blasphemy laws that imposed the death penalty for insulting Islam. Christians have been under attack here in Iran, Iraq, and Egypt, among others, and those of us of a similar faith should be sickened by it all. Regarding the Middle East, we'll be looking for answers to some of the following. Over the coming year, will the new leaders be answerable to an emboldened citizenry? Who does the United States deal with in each country? There will be many disparate parties and factions, far different from the past where it was one authoritarian figure in each. The old cooperation from the likes of Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt when it came to combating terrorists is gone. Yes, in a twisted way, Gaddafi, himself the ultimate terrorist, was useful in the war on Al-Qaeda. The entire regional security apparatus is at risk. How do we fill the void? We can't. Next up, the U.S. economy. The news has been great. Manufacturing continues to cook, with readings from the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index and the Institute for Supply Management showing an economy that is cranking out goods at multi-year record levels. In fact, the 71.2 reading on the Chicago PMI was its best since 1988. The ISM, 61.4, hit a level not seen since 2004. Construction spending was down for January, but then factory orders for the month were the best in 4 years. Friday's employment report for February revealed that the economy added 192,000 jobs, as expected, and that the private sector added some 222,000, another solid figure. True, after the deep recession we've been through, the economy should be adding even more positions during the recovery, but the figures were better than recent numbers on this front, and the unemployment rate fell to 8.9%. That's the good news. The bad news is that the number of those actually looking for work hasn't budged in ages, allowing the unemployment rate to drop from 9.8% to 8.9% in 3 months, unheard of, because the number of those counting themselves as part of the labor force hasn't increased and has in fact shrunk some. Of course, that's just not dealing with reality, and in fact the real unemployment rate remains around 16%. But things are at least looking up, no doubt. What isn't getting better, however, are wages. Average hourly pay for February was unchanged, and an earlier reading on January consumption revealed a consumer that was beginning to pull in their horns some compared to the previous pace, and this was before the oil price shock. As for oil and inflation, nothing can kill an economy faster, save a 9/11 style attack, than a huge spike in the price of gasoline, and by the end of the weekend, many of us will be paying $4 for a gallon of gasoline, or $50 plus to fill up the tank. That's real money. Add to this the fact that those who are finally finding work are often receiving far less than they were paid in their prior position, and probably with less benefits, and you get a sense of just how fragile this recovery remains. But what of inflation overall? I'm not changing my tune one bit. Yes, higher commodities prices, including for oil, are going to hit the developing world particularly hard, including those governments who feel compelled to heavily subsidize foodstuffs to keep the peace and thus tack on debt. It will slow growth, and growth will be impacted in Europe, where with their heavy tax system on oil means that Europeans are paying $8 per gallon and up these days. Save for Germany and one or two others, growth in the EU is anemic, as it was before this new tax is added to the austerity programs being enacted. But I believe that when it comes to other commodities, what we are witnessing is a speculative bubble. I thought one of the stupider items of the week came out of the International Monetary Fund, which told us that from 2010 to 2050, food prices will essentially keep marching ever upward due to a developing world whose diet is improving as their economies improve. Yes, folks rising up from poverty and tasting the middle class for the first time want to eat better. But to then say the world will not be able to boost production enough to meet demand is of a Malthusian bent that I'll be able to prove in just 1 year was a total bunch of crap. For starters, note to the IMF. If the world is going to have such a hard time producing food, then explain to me why it is that the price of rice, a staple in the developing world, has fallen from $25 to $14 since peaking in 2008. We have two things going on when it comes to food. Horrible luck when it comes to the weather, with historic catastrophic floods and droughts in key growing states, Russia and Australia for starters, as well as massive speculation. Unless we have entered a permanent period of drought and pestilence for the rest of our lives, the farmers of the world, increasingly from Africa, by the way, we'll have some good growing weather again. I've been writing of something I think is critically important on this front. Those terrible catastrophic floods in Australia have also filled the reservoirs there for the first time in about 10 years. The potential exists for boom harvest, if not by end of this year, certainly next. As for the speculation in the commodities pits, I'm reminded of how some of us were told in 2008 that the reason oil was on its way to a record 147 was solely because of demand. Then, suddenly, from mid-July to mid-December of that year, oil collapsed from 147 to the 30s. It wasn't all because of the financial crisis that then threw the world into a tailspin. Some speculators got their heads handed to them. But again, no doubt, this current price spike, fueled by supply issues and/or speculation, is going to put a damper on economic growth worldwide. And this is part of my story when it comes to equities underperforming over the full year. Next up, Europe. I've said that the continent needs most is growth, and outside of Germany, it's going to be awful hard to come by in 2011. There's no way many European nations, including basket cases, Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, can meet their obligations and begin to put dents in their debt loads without 4% type growth, and much of Europe will grow in the 1% to 2% range for 2011, if that. More likely, should the oil shock continue a while, many European nations will slide back into recession or fail to get out of it in the first place, a la Ireland. Because, you see, there is another exacerbating situation. The European Central Bank and its chief, Jean-Claude Trichet, is prepared to raise interest rates next month to combat inflation. This, in turn, will kill any thought of a recovery in Ireland, which desperately needs lower interest rates, not higher ones. But as the ECB raises rates, the rate on many an Irish mortgage will rise apace. The combination of austerity programs kicking in, including reduced pension benefits and/or increases in the retirement age, higher interest rates, a food and oil price shock, and a probable massive influx of immigrants from North Africa further straining social services is going to lead to a Europe in turmoil this spring. It's also why the success or failure of British Prime Minister David Cameron's austerity program is so vitally important. If Cameron's Britain survives the coming pain with its head still high, that will send a super signal to the rest of Europe and across the pond to the United States. But if Britain's economy tumbles back into full-blown recession, then all bets are off when it comes to others proceeding with needed fiscal discipline. So we all should be cheering for Cameron and crossing our fingers. But speaking of the U.S. and its deficit dilemma, Congress avoided a government shutdown for 2 weeks with yet another short-term funding deal, but this can't go on forever. Eventually, it has to face up to its obligations, including a decision on raising the debt ceiling. For all the talk of who is to blame for our current mess, though, there is only one man who stands above the rest in terms of responsibility, and that is Barack Obama. He is the one who now has to lead. He is the one who has to give an address or two from the Oval Office and give Americans the facts on our looming entitlement calamity. Obama is the one who has to tell Americans it's time to sacrifice. But the president and his advisors are convinced they can play their game of chicken until after the 2012 election. I'm here to tell you that unless the financial markets, including those overseas, believe the United States has come to grips with its deficits, January 2013 will be too late. We will meet our Waterloo at some point in 2012. The president had his chance to begin to lay out the facts to the American people with a State of the Union address, and instead he virtually cemented his legacy as one of the worst presidents in our history. Obama can still turn things around, but there's little reason to believe he will do so. And no, growth in the economy will not bail us out of a looming debt-to-GDP ratio of 100%, with exploding spending to come in the mighty triad, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the latter two powered by Obamacare in the out years. Until the American people hear the truth, you will continue to get absurd poll numbers like we had this week with the latest NBC News Wall Street Journal survey wherein, when asked if cuts to Medicare were necessary to, quote, significantly reduce the deficit, 18% said yes, while 54% said no. Warren Buffett was on CNBC this week and said, "You can't stop this country." Wrong, Warren. Debt can stop this country, just like debt stopped many an individual and corporation during the financial crisis and has stopped Greece and Ireland. As for the public versus private debate, here again, the people just don't have a clue, which is why the polls are decidedly mixed on whether public union members, such as teachers, need to pay more for their pension and health benefits. By some new studies, state and local pension obligations are underfunded by $1.5 trillion to $1.9 trillion. Unless you tell me that we are about to embark on a 20-year bull run in stocks with consistent annual returns on equities of 15%, thus making a blended portfolio rate of 8% plus on existing pension assets achievable, then the only way to make up the difference in underfunding is further reduced services and tax hikes, neither of which, incidentally, is conducive to the kind of growth needed to fuel a 20-year boom in equities. For now, however, Republicans have their work cut out for them educating a people who refuse to face facts. Don't look for any help from the president. As noted earlier, the major averages all registered fractional gains, with the Dow Jones tacking on 0.3% this past week to 12,169, while the S&P and NASDAQ added a whopping 0.1% each. That's all for this week. For further information, go to stocksnews.com and click on Week in Review. Have a great one. Speak to you next Saturday.